So I am going to talk to today about our work in the area which I believe can be looked as a kind of a quest for controlling quantum world. And in this quest, what we are doing is we are trying to basically isolate and control some simple quantum objects, and then from them we start building more and more complex quantum systems. And there are two types of directions which we're exploring with them. One of them involves basically new physics, physics with these engineered many body systems. And in particular, one of the goals is to basically create and probe new entangled quantum states of matter. But of course, we are also interested in a kind of broader applications of these techniques to things like quantum information processing, quantum computation, communication, and metrology. And of course, this kind of all of these topics are now, you hear a lot about, but actually it's important sometimes to take a step back and, note that despite all of this, remarkable excitement in this field of, quantum science, we are facing two very important open problems. And specifically, these problems or challenges are, shown here. So on one hand, right now we really do not know if and how we can build truly large-scale quantum systems composed of millions of, working, coherent, and, connected qubits. But even more significantly, even if I was now to, build such a system and give it to basically any one of you, and this is already kind of a remarkable group, esteemed group, select group, and, even more broadly, you wouldn't know what to do with that. So in other words, I think there are some, of course, examples, things like Shor's algorithm that we know, but there are only very few examples, where we know that quantum machines could really do things that classical machines cannot do. So, and that's this second challenge which I call, sometimes useful application, quantum advantage challenge. So, how do we address these kind of challenges? So, I like to think about that as a kind of ultimate quantum rivalry, and you can think about that and from different perspectives. You could say that, well, it's a competition between different quantum platforms. Maybe some people would think it's a competition between different countries even. But actually, I like to think about it as a kind of much more kind of high level, I would say a little bit kind of Eastern philosophical kind of challenge. So this is a competition between two contradictory forces of nature. One is a force of controllability. So basically, the ability to really, control, for example, individual qubits, with high fidelity and so on. And another one is scalability. We would like to have a lot of them. And basically, these forces, they, this contradiction between these two forces is present in many areas of human activity, even beyond science. So, for example, if you take, a large group of extremely well-educated theoretical physicists and put them into one organization, by definition, this organization will be very challenging to control. So, and it's kind of like it's an example, where this which shows, how these two contradictory forces kind of interact. And that's actually certainly the case in the domain of quantum science, where what we would like to do is we would like to scale up the systems and while maintaining this good degree of control and coherence. And so I'd say the current frontier now is that we would like to build systems with over 100, controlled and coherent qubits, such that we can really implement tasks that classical computers cannot do, and and use them for two complementary goals. One of them is to kind of learn from these experiments to try then to build bigger and even better quantum machines. But on the other hand, address the second challenge of useful application. And in particular, I would like to, in today's talk, focus, on scientific applications, for example, in many body physics and understanding entangled states. But with that, actually, I would like to kind of maybe introduce a little bit, you know, the notion and kind of argue that, you know, these systems now become, you know, big enough, programmable enough, and coherent enough such that we can enter the regime where we can, by, you know, playing with the systems, we can actually make already some discoveries which would be impossible to do on classical computers. And I would like to kind of introduce this notion of this age of quantum discovery. And actually, I would like to argue that we are kind of entering this age already. So I hope you agree with me by the end of my talk. So, okay, with that in mind, what I'd like to do today is focus indeed on our experiments in which we build scalable quantum system using Rydberg atom arrays. I will introduce, you know, various ingredients of that and, you know, show some recent results, you know, where we can now control, you know, hundreds of atoms in two spatial dimensions. I will then give a few examples, you know, of basically scientific applications involving, in particular, probing quantum phases and phase transitions, you know, using the system to explore non-equilibrium dynamics, you know, something which is by now known as under the name of quantum many-body scars. And I hope very much I will have some time at the end to tell you about some of our most recent, quite exciting results, in particular, in which we probe the onset of topological spin liquids of the toric code type, and also maybe briefly talk about some applications to quantum optimization. So, you know, please feel free to interrupt me at any point, and I'll also try to stop in the middle of the talk to maybe see if there are any questions. But so, in our approach, we are going to use cold neutral atoms to build quantum systems, and those have a number of key advantages. So those atoms have excellent coherence properties. So, for example, you know, if you think about modern optical clocks, they actually build, you know, atomic clocks, they are built from cold atoms, now neutral atoms. And another important advantage is that it's very easy to create a large number of atoms. In fact, you know, around us in every room where we're sitting, there is a lot of, you know, atoms and molecules are flying around. Would it be not nice to use them as qubits? Well, in principle, yes, but there are also some challenges. So first of all, the atoms in the gas phase interact weakly with each other. And secondly, neutral atoms are very hard to control individually in large numbers. So in fact, all of these atoms and molecules around us, you know, is just kind of following each of them is kind of, you know, an impossible task. So motivated by this consideration, a couple of years ago, we started to basically think about a new approach for building scalable quantum system. And this approach, you know, is as follows. So what we do is we start with a very low pressure gas of atoms in a vacuum chamber, in a vacuum cell, which we basically, you know, cool by using the, by now standard techniques of laser cooling. What we do, we shine light on them and basically the light slows down their motion. And then what we do is we shine into the vacuum chamber the tightly focused beams of light, which act as so-called optical tweezers. So basically they attract the atoms to the point of the highest intensity. And we focus this beam so tightly that each of these tweezers can host at most one atom. So in practice, we don't just do it with one tweezer, but we do it now with hundreds of tweezers and basically try to load them all at the same time. And what happens is on each given kind of experimental attempt, we end up with kind of probabilistic loading. Some traps are loaded with single atoms and some are empty. And you know, what it means is that the system has a kind of a lot of entropy. So in order to get rid of entropy, what we do is we simply take a picture of these atoms, figure out which traps are full and which are empty, and then basically remove the empty traps and then rearrange the filled trap in any kind of desired configuration. So using this procedure, we end up with atoms which are sitting a couple of micrometers from each other. At these distances, atoms in the ground state do not interact. The interaction between them is completely negligible. So in order to induce interactions and, for example, to do things like quantum logic operations, what we do is we promote the atoms coherently into the excited states, into the so-called Rydberg states. And so in the Rydberg state, what happens is that basically electron orbital size grows dramatically, and then atoms start really feeling each other and start talking to each other. So, and that's the approach that I'm going to be talking about. It's the approach which we started, you know, a few years ago, and it's a collaboration between my group, the group of Markus Greiner, my colleague at Harvard, and the group of Vladan Vuletic, my colleague at MIT. So here is the kind of schematic of the first generation of the experiment. I'll talk about second generation later on. So the key element of this system is this device, which is called acousto-optic deflector. So some of you might have seen it in a kind of, it's a the device which is used in a barcode scanner in supermarkets. So, and basically what this device does is it takes as an input a laser beam and a number of radio frequency tones. Then for each input tone, this, you know, acousto-optic deflector just deflects the incoming laser beam by a certain angle. And so if you put in a set of tones, then you can create a set of optical beams, which you unfocused in the vacuum chamber, creates this tweezer array. And we have a second objective, which we use to basically take a picture of these atoms and then activate this feedback loop. So basically, in order to get rid of one beam, what you do, you just remove one, you know, tone of this radio frequency. Or if you want to, for example, shift the atom, what you do, you just simply change the frequency, you chirp the frequency of one of the tone. So that's actually the first generation also of students and postdocs, many of whom are now went on to their own faculty positions and actually are doing extremely creative and actually great work. So just a few more words about, you know, the mechanism which we use to induce the interactions is we excite the atoms into the so-called Rydberg states. So this is basically a state with high principal quantum number, which we learn about when we talk about hydrogen atom, for example. And the two important properties of those states, which we would like to utilize, is that they have a combination of long lifetime and strong interactions. So specifically, the van der Waal interaction, the interaction which we talk about, scales asymptotically as 11th power of principal quantum numbers. And in a state with n equals 100, it's 14 orders of magnitude stronger than van der Waal interaction in the ground state. So 14 orders of magnitude is a big number, and we can make a very good use of that. So specifically, if we drive atoms coherently, you know, if the atoms are sitting very far away, they will undergo Rabi oscillations, independent Rabi oscillations, without feeling each other's presence. But if you start now bringing these atoms, you know, close and close, and if you excite the state with large n, what will happen eventually is that at some point, these interactions between the atoms will take over. And basically, it will shift this doubly excited state far away from resonance. And what it will imply is that, you know, once the atoms are close enough, you know, closer than the so-called blockade radius, what will happen is that you will be able to excite only one of these atoms, you know, either of them, but never both together. So that's the essence of the so-called Rydberg blockade. And this Rydberg blockade, it turns out, you know, is a very useful tool to, for example, entangle atoms, to do, you know, quantum logic operations. And the reason is that basically, once, you know, atoms are close enough, once you're under the condition of this Rydberg blockade, then this entanglement procedure is insensitive to things like atomic motion, exact position of the atom. So it's very, very forgiving. So to summarize, what we will be doing in the rest of the talk is we'll be, you know, preparing, you know, some arrays of atoms. We will kind of sort these atoms into various configurations. We'll then, you know, shine pulses of light to basically manipulate the atomic internal states. And then after that, we'll just take pictures of atoms, you know, in a way which is state selective. So for example, like here, we take a picture of atoms in the ground state. So this basically red circles means that atom is in a Rydberg state in this case. So that's kind of the idea. And what I will kind of talk, focus mostly in this talk is to use this system for as a programmable quantum simulator that follows some of the very early ideas which kind of resulted in the field of quantum computation, in particular, this Feynman's ideas of simulating physics with computers, where he noted that if you have, you know, system, for example, of n quantum bits, to simulate, for example, dynamics will require a solution to the 2 to the n coupled equations. And basically, you know, when n exceeds something like, you know, 50 or 60, it becomes very, very hard. And so the alternative approach would be to implement a model of interacting system where you basically have some kind of standard set of qubits. But, you know, you kind of design the interactions between in a programmable way such that you can really have something like a quantum simulator. And this is exactly what we are going to kind of use this approach, which I just discussed for. So to be specific, you know, let's consider first a one-dimensional system of these atoms arranged in a linear chain. And assume that, for example, the separation between atoms is kind of basically fixed so that it's, you know, the distance between each nearest neighbor is equal. And, you know, what we can now ask, the question is, you know, okay, so what, you know, how can we understand the dynamics? And here you can just basically, you know, write down the Hamiltonian for this kind of system, which is both driven by the laser and there is a detuning and there is some interaction. And to understand, to gain some insights into basically properties of this Hamiltonian, what we could do is just we could consider its ground state. So we can quantify this ground state in terms of this laser detuning, which kind of acts as a chemical potential, and also in terms of the interaction range, basically, you know, or the range of blockade, which I already talked about. So specifically, if the atoms are non-interacting, then the ground state will be solely determined by this detuning. So if this detuning is negative, then, you know, you basically don't want to have any atoms in a Rydberg state. You know, all n's should be zero, so atoms should be in the ground state. If it's positive, then all atoms should be in an excited state. But of course, the state like this is not compatible with Rydberg blockade. So if you now turn on the short range interactions, you know, which basically would mean that only nearest neighbors are blockaded, then you will not be able to kind of access a state like that. So the only state you will be able to access is a state where every other atom is excited. So this is a basically an anti-ferromagnetic state, you know, where you have basically a Z2 symmetry broken. So, but of course, what you can do, you can now, you know, go on and, you know, extend the range of interactions even further, and then you will be able to excite only every third atom. So it corresponds to breaking of Z3 symmetry, you know, and then, you know, if you extend it more, it will be every fourth atom, Z4 broken symmetry, and so on. So that's kind of a phase diagram, which actually has been worked out by our colleagues, Subir Sajdev and his collaborators a few years ago. And we can now explore this phase diagram by basically starting with all atoms in the ground state and then trying to adiabatically enter these various phases. And, you know, here is some of the first results. So basically, in this case, we have a chain of 13 atoms. And then, you know, here, for example, we enter this state with this anti-ferromagnetic order, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. But, you know, if we now, for example, change the interactions or maybe change even the distance between atoms, bring them closer together. So in this case, you know, not only nearest neighbor, but second nearest neighbor is blockaded. So you end up with a state up, down, down, up, down, down, et cetera. And, you know, that goes on. And there you can, we can see also this Z4 state. So basically, this example indicates, you know, how by just simply changing, programming the system, you know, changing the atom position, changing the interaction strength, we can really very easily basically access, you know, a wide variety of this kind of new phases and study, for example, phase transitions and do stuff like that. So here is one example. So in this case, you know, we, you know, go to the chain of 51 atoms. So this is a 51 atom chain, all atoms in the ground state. And we, for example, try to make a transition into the state with anti-ferromagnetic order. And actually, if we do that, you know, we don't always get a perfect order across the entire chain. So more typical is, you know, you get some segments which are ordered, you know, and then another segment, and in between them, there are these domain walls. And what you can do, you can, for example, study, you know, these domain walls, you know, the density, the variance, various properties. And from that, you can, for example, very easily identify where the phase transition occurs. So here, you know, what you see is domain wall density is basically, you know, is changing smoothly across the phase transition, but its variance, you know, peaks at some point. So here is a point where the system does not know in which state it should really, you know, peak. So it's exactly the point where phase transition occurs, and actually it turns out that, you know, for this example, it's actually in a good agreement with predictions of Subir and colleagues. But actually, you can do much more with this system, because you can not only look at this kind of global properties, you can also try to kind of access microscopic properties. So, for example, you know, once in a while, you know, we would get a perfect ordering of this entire array, and we could just ask the question, what's the probability that a given microscopic state, you know, occurs after this phase transition? Actually, it turns out, you know, from all states, this one, this with perfect order, is actually by far more probable out of all kind of, you know, exponentially large number of different states. And in fact, you can even use this kind of probability to kind of hit this perfectly ordered state to kind of benchmark your system. And in fact, you know, early on, you know, the probability was actually very small, but, you know, by now, by optimizing this, you know, in systems of this scale, we can basically easily create the states with like double-digit probability. But you can also do things like look at correlation functions. So you can, this is the, you know, in this case, an anti-ferromagnetic, you know, state. So you have this up-down correlation function, which, you know, basically decays, you know, and from here you can extract, for example, things like correlation length. So basically that shows you that we have this wide variety of systems, you know, with of tools, you know, with which we can really have quite unique insights into things like phase transitions, especially quantum dynamics. And so basically, you know, using this approach over the last couple of years, we actually, you know, had a lot of fun exploring, you know, various aspects of the system. So for example, you can use this system to realize, you know, high fidelity entanglement and parallel quantum gate operations. We can use it to explore novel phase transitions, for example, in the Z2, Z3, and Z4 phases. We spent quite a bit of time studying this non-equilibrium entanglement dynamics, something I will, you know, talk about a little bit later. And we also were able to engineer large-scale entanglement. So here is an example where we created a 20-atom GAG state. At the time, it was the largest GAG state. So basically, all of these things, directions are very closely connected because they involve coherent, high-fidelity, either analog or digital quantum evolution. So fast forward to kind of about a year ago, early in 2020, we actually carried out a major upgrade. So we, you know, upgraded the system to what we now call generation 2 tweezer array. And the major addition to the setup was the addition of this element, which is called spatial light modulator. What it is basically a computer-generated hologram, which can, for example, you know, produce two-dimensional arrays of laser beams. And, you know, when you basically focus it onto the vacuum chamber, you can see this array is basically, you know, consisting from actually over 1,000 of traps. Now, we need to kind of learn how to sort atoms in these arrays. And the way how we do it is by basically using two acousto-optic deflectors, which are oriented 90 degrees relative to each other. And, you know, basically what by doing that, what we can do, we can just move atoms within columns and rows of these arrays. Then, of course, and it's all computer controlled. So then, of course, what happens also about a year ago is that, you know, we had some unexpected developments where basically, you know, and this is a historical day where actually it was the last day when like all students and postdocs were allowed in the lab, you know. And, you know, in this last few days before we had to kind of, you know, shut everything down, we converted this experiment to completely remote operation. And so in what follows, all data which I will show you have been taken remotely. And so here is kind of some examples. So we are, you know, here we are trying to load, you know, 600 traps. And then we are trying to sort them into kind of 300 arrays, you know, and then basically here is some kind of movie. So it's actually kind of slowed down quite a bit compared to real experimental repetition. And you see that, you know, these rearrangements, not all of them are perfect. So there is a defect, you know, once in a while here and there, but, you know, with reasonable probability, we can, you know, prepare the atoms without a defect. So each trap is filled with more than 99% probability. And for example, once in a while, we have this, you know, defect-free, you know, 300 atom arrays. But the beauty is that, you know, and here it's just a square array. The beauty is that we can easily not just create square arrays, but we can create tilted square, triangular, hexagonal, basically any lattice that you would like. And so here is the kind of the attempt to generate an arbitrary pattern pre-programmed, and it, you know, this comes out exactly as we want. And this all can be done with actually quite high, you know, preparation fidelity. Okay, so what are we going to do with this? And the first thing, of course, we want to kind of benchmark this system and, you know, do some kind of simple, you know, quantum simulation experiment. So the easiest thing would be to extend this, you know, the work that we have done in the past to two dimensions. For example, if we focus now on the square lattice array, then if we adjust the interaction such that only nearest neighbors are coupled, then of course what will happen is that you will basically the ground state for that will be an anti-ferromagnetic phase. We actually call it a checkerboard phase, where basically every other atom is excited, so that's the lattice structure, and you know, that's kind of one state we can realize. But you know, of course, by now increasing the atom separation, we can explore much broader array of phases. And in fact, you know, these are some of these, you know, phases. So in fact, already even for this simple array, due to the long range nature of interactions, this phase diagram is quite rich. And as you will see in a second, we can now explore and observe and explore most of these phases. But actually, even it turns out, even some of these very simple transition from the kind of what's called disordered phase to the anti-ferromagnetic slash checkerboard phase, this basically corresponds to the paradigmatic 2+1D Ising quantum phase transition. Even that simple transition has never been observed. So let's just see what we can do about that. So here, you know, we start with a square lattice with atoms, you know, separated, you know, quite far from each other, so that's only nearest neighbor is blockaded. And then what we try to do adiabatic sweep. And indeed, you know, once in a while, we have these pictures of this perfectly ordered arrays across the entire lattice. Now, again, not on each single shot, you get this perfect ordering. So you can try to quantify it in different ways. You can, for example, look at correlation function. Here again, it's up, down, up, down, up, down correlation function. But now it's, you know, basically spreads across almost entire two-dimensional array. And what we can also do, we can also look at distribution of these microscopic states. And again, you know, the two most probable states are the states basically with perfect ordering. You know, they're just two complementary states, you know, with perfect ordering across the entire array. And the probability to prepare the state can be, you know, quantified as a function of the array size. It scales as 0.97 to the power of n. It means that basically, you know, there is a 3% error per atom you know, in this entire preparation procedure from the beginning to the end. So these kind of techniques basically allow us to start benchmarking these systems and kind of explore how well it you know, the system performs, but it also allows us to kind of explore things like, for example, quantum phase transition. And so as already mentioned, the phase transition into this state should be in a kind of paradigmatic, you know, 2+1D universality class. So for this phase transition, the critical exponents are actually known. So this is a relativistic transition. So dynamical critical exponent is one, and this correlation length critical exponent is 0.63. But it has never been observed previously. So basically, to kind of study that transition, what we do, we basically go across transition at different speed. And we use this so-called quantum Keeble-Zurich mechanism to basically connect the dynamics across the phase transition to this universal scaling exponent. So what one sees in practice is actually quite dramatic. If you go fast, then the correlation lengths are quite short. If you go slower and slower, the correlation lengths grow before they become, you know, basically everything becomes correlated across the entire array. And so, you know, we can, you know, see how this correlation grows as a function of speed and as a function where you stop. And to basically extract this correlation scaling, what we use is what's called universal scaling collapse. We use the fact that close to phase transition, you know, the dynamics, everything, you know, should be universal. So if we rescale it with the speed with which we grow and with proper exponents, all curves should collapse, and indeed they do. And from this collapse, we can actually extract with the, you know, kind of second digit precision, this correlation length exponent, which actually is quite close to what is expected theoretically. So this is, you know, a first observation of this Ising quantum phase transition in 2+1 dimension, but it's also kind of a benchmark for this quantum aspect of many body dynamics. For example, for classical transitions, the correlation with this exponents are different, you know, so and this is, you know, we observe, you know, is something which is consistent with the quantum transition. So, okay, but it's of course only start, so we can now extend all of this kind of studies to many other phases, and in fact we kind of observed, you know, most of them by now. So what you see that is basically phases correspond to kind of different ordering, and we can, you know, look at things like, for example, we can try to map, you know, phase diagram, benchmark it against the MRG, you know, so this is actually the kinds of stuff that we have been doing. So and some of these phases actually are quite exotic. They have never been observed, and phase transitions are quite interesting. So it's kind of, you know, very exciting and, you know, fruitful direction. So this is a kind of stuff which basically we are exploring now. We are exploring 2D phase transitions, you know, with this in particular, including, you know, transitions driven by these long range interactions. We're studying their dynamics. We are now starting to look at, you know, probing topological phases. So I'd like to talk about it if we have a little bit of time. And I'll also start these ideas to use this system for combinatorial optimization. So I would like to now describe some of these kind of recent results, but maybe let me pause here and see if you guys have any questions about kind of the foundations of this.
I had a question, Tisha. So for the Ising model, did you measure something for which there is no theoretical prediction? For example, real-time dynamics, conductivity, or actually here there is no conductivity because of Z2, but some, I can easily imagine writing down things which are real-time dynamics for which it's hard to maybe, there's some universal function of some frequency or something like that. Can you, they're all this work by Subir over last, I don't know, 20 years trying to predict universal real-time dynamics using various.
Yes. So I will talk about it next, you know. Okay. So, and this would be really kind of something which is away from equilibrium. So basically, okay, my understanding, and you know, you probably know it much better than I, is kind of equilibrium properties for this kind of, you know, around this Ising quantum phase transition, they are reasonably well understood. But if you kick the system away from equilibrium, then the real fun starts. And I will show one example. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, but please feel free to interrupt me at any point. So let me just, you know, give you, you know, a couple of examples of fun projects which we are kind of exploring. And so one of them is requested by following a special request by Tarun. I'm talking about non-equilibrium dynamics. And this is related to something which, you know, is now called many-body scars. So basically, this kind of goes back to some of the very first experiments, which we did with, you know, still kind of relatively small arrays. So in this case, this was an array of five particles, where we prepared this antiferromagnetic state. And then very rapidly, we basically quenched, instead of just stopping there, we changed our detuning just across the phase transition. And to be honest, our motivation at the time was to see how the system will formalize. But what we observed was something actually is kind of striking. So indeed, you know, initially you have this order, and then, you know, after a while you wait and this order disappears. It looks like system is formalized, but then you wait a little bit. And what happens is that the complementary order, you know, if this was up, down, up, down, this down, up, down, up, down, up, reappears, then this order disappears and it reappears again. And this dynamics continues. Initially, when we saw it, we thought, oh, that's probably a finite size effect. It's just five atoms, too small a system size. But then you start doing this experiment for 9-atom or 51-atom chain. And if you, for example, if you look at something like a order parameter domain wall density, you basically see, you know, exact the same thing. So you initially have some, you know, ordering, right? You quench, and then, you know, domain wall density grows to, you know, basically close to a value which is close to sort of, you know, thermal value would be 0.5, but then somehow, you know, this continues and, you know, dynamics continues, and then the order reappears and order disappears, reappears again, and it goes on for some time, eventually decaying. So what's going on? We were actually quite puzzled initially, and because this was not, for example, we did not quench it at any integrable kind of point, so this should not be integrable system, it should really thermalize. And, you know, that kind of observation actually motivated, you know, a number of theoretical studies. So I cannot talk about all of them. But one of them is this kind of the idea of quantum many-body scars. So what's the idea is basically related to the following. So, in classical, in a single particle kind of theory of chaos, there is a notion of quantum scars. And so this notion can be understood if you look, for example, at this, you know, paradigmatic, you know, classical chaotic system, basically the billiard, where most of trajectories are completely chaotic. But there are a few trajectories, for example, here by symmetry, which are closed. So they are not stable. This trajectory is unstable, but nevertheless, you know, they exist. And so then you can ask, you know, what is the, you know, if you quantize a system, you know, what will the effect of this few closed trajectories going to be? You might think that, you know, they should really not be have any effect because, you know, of an uncertainty principle and so on. But actually, it turns out not to be the case. So it turns out that associated with some of these trajectories, there are some eigenstates which very much resemble those trajectories. And so what, you know, some theorists, and in particular the groups of Dima Abanin and Maxim Serban pointed out is that, you know, maybe what we observed here is a kind of a many-body version of this kind of many-body scary, of this quantum scarring kind of phenomenon. So how can you think about that? So there are a few ways to think about it. So basically in terms of the spectrum of the system, so it turns out that most of the states in this system, in this Hamiltonian are completely chaotic, but there is this manifold of states which is spaced periodically in terms of energy, you know, which are kind of away from this chaos, you know, and this is this kind of manifold which we exactly populated in these experiments. So that's why these periodic collapses and revivals appear. So you can make this analogy even a little bit more precise by looking at matrix product states. So it turns out that you can actually write down a matrix product states with one dimension two, where you can kind of reproduce these oscillations also again in terms of these unstable trajectories. And basically, this unstable trajectory system stays on this trajectory for some time before eventually, you know, thermalizing, kind of falling into this kind of black holes. So, you know, as I already mentioned, you know, this work, you know, has stimulated a lot of theoretical studies. And in fact, you know, still now every week there is new paper kind of appears. And what we can now, actually the people who really kind of led early ideas was Hannes and so on. But, you know, basically what we can do now, we can ask a question, can we now, for example, test these ideas of quantum scars in two dimensions? And indeed we can, and it's actually quite spectacular. So if we start with some of these lattices, and they're all, by the way, bipartite lattices, and do exactly this experiment where we prepare the state and then do this quench, we almost always observe these collapses and revivals. So here is one example. So I think it's a honeycomb lattice, you know, where which we first prepare, you know, there is this anti-ferromagnetic state. But then, you know, we quench is detuning, and initially, you know, after this quench, the order disappears, and then we wait a little bit and the order reappears. And then, you know, it kind of keeps going. So basically, we can quantify it in different ways. So this is, for example, sublattice population. So, you know, what we found is wide variety of 2D bipartite lattices support these many body scars. And what's kind of nice in this situation is that because we now have access to all of these different lattices, we can start studying, you know, questions like, you know, how stable, you know, what determines stability of the scars, you know, how does decay rate depend on various kind of configuration, etc. So the in particular, one can ask the question: can one stabilize these scars? And this is something that I would like to briefly talk about. So the idea here is the following. So suppose now that instead of quenching to a fixed detuning, we quench to a time-varying detuning. You might ask, well, why do we want to do it? Because typically, you know, if you start driving system, you know, kind of periodically, you just, you know, expect that it will heat up. But we know that it's not always the case. So we know that, for example, like, you know, in the cases when systems have many body localization or undergo slow relaxation, we can have these effects like this discrete time crystal, you know, phenomena where you basically, you know, have some observables which revive, you know, with period which is multiple of this driving period. And you might think, well, maybe scars thermalizing slowly, maybe something like this can occur. So that was our motivation a little bit to look. And once again, when we did this experiment, we saw a surprise. So what do we observe? So if we can, if we quench to a fixed detuning, we see the scars which decay. If we now quench to detuning, which changes in time, we observe these, you know, collapses and revivals, you know, which are much more enhanced compared to the undriven case. So in fact, this enhancement is substantial. It can be, you know, four or five times in a lifetime. And even more interestingly, in this driven case, what we observe is that this oscillation frequency basically locks to the half, exactly to the half drive of a driving frequency. That can be shown, you know, here. So here's, for example, a modulation frequency and the frequency of the fit. And then actually for a wide variety of systems, sorry for kind of going fast there. So this locking occurs. So what's going on? So to understand, you know, this origin of this robust response, we actually considered several models. And one of them is this kind of toy model where you apply this sequentially, this Rydberg blockade Hamiltonian, it's called PXP model. And these kind of pulses, which correspond to effectively to this detuning, you know, variation. And actually, it turns out that you, by looking at this, you know, kind of Floquet unitary, you can really learn quite a bit. So first of all, it turns out that, you know, if this detuning pulses are such that this phase that the atoms pick up is exactly pi, you know, due to the particle hole symmetry of PXP model, you will always have basically perfect revivals, no matter what initial state that you start. But, you know, what is interesting is that, you know, typically if you go away from this phase being exact pi, then most of the states, you know, immediately, you know, this echo is not perfect. And, you know, basically, you know, these revivals disappear. But, you know, this is not true for this scarring state. For the special scarring state, we observe this broad plateau, you know, regardless of exact phase, we observe this stable collapses and revivals. And, you know, we can see this experiment. We observe, you know, very stable response across many systems, spacing, geometries. And actually, the only thing which is required is that system is large enough. So it's really a many body effect. So, you know, based on that, we now are thinking that this robust stabilization is very much akin to this what's called prefermal time crystalline response. And what's cool is that it really allows us kind of almost for the first time to try to really steer system through this kind of high dimensional Hilbert space. So basically what is shown here, I think the first ever kind of movies, which kind of, you know, give you a sense of how all relevant, you know, states, you know, evolve in a system, evolve in time. So this is for nine atom chain. And actually, if you look at this a little bit more closely, you realize that not only this dry-driven, you know, scars live for much longer time, but also this, by driving, you kind of modify the trajectory in such a way that entanglement entropy, you know, doesn't grow very fast. So it's, I think it's actually very cool, and I think it points to something, you know, potentially very interesting and kind of very new. So I don't know how well, you know, I'm doing on time. Do I have still, you know, 5 or 10 minutes?
Yes, 10 minutes.
Okay, so let me then maybe give you one more. I'll give you one more example. And this is but perhaps, again, something that at least, you know, some parts of the perimeter community can be interested. So this is related to basically creating and probing topological phases of matter. And specifically, something which is called spin liquid. So spin liquid is, you know, as many of you know, is an emergent phenomenon in frustrated system and originally pointed out by Anderson. So for example, for a simple, you know, anti-ferromagnetic system on triangular lattice, if you basically, you know, orient two of the spins anti-parallel to each other, where would you put the third spin? And basically, this kind of, you know, ideas, you know, stimulated this, you know, kind of development of this what's called entangled quantum materials. So notions like resonating valence bonds and so on with these ideas of kind of strongly correlated spin liquids have been now developed for almost 5 decades. And I'd say there is no conclusive experimental evidence in any system up to date of creating such a phase of matter. But then 2 decades ago, there was a renewed attention in these ideas. And this is thanks to the papers in particular by Alexei Kitaev, who pointed out that, you know, basically you can use this kind of states for fault tolerant or topological quantum computation. And paradigmatic example of that is this kind of toric code. So this toric code, you know, basically is characterized, you know, as a, you know, can be characterized in terms of this kind of string operators, which are basically, you know, for example, here an X and Z operators, and you can think about it as a kind of coherent, you know, guess of all of these closed strings of all of these loops. So about a year ago, two of our theory colleagues, you know, Subir and Ashwin kind of started, you know, thinking about if this is something that we can, you know, probe experimentally. And in fact, they came up with, you know, some very specific ideas, you know, how we can implement in study such states in our Rydberg-Gatton arrays. In fact, we now, you know, studied both of these, you know, proposals, and actually I will focus mostly on these proposals where, you know, which shown here, where the atoms are sitting on the links of Kagame lattice. So the idea here is to introduce basically frustration, and from this frustration, hopefully something like spin liquid can emerge. So let me kind of talk a little bit more about that. So it turns out that, you know, basically, you know, if you start with the system of this kind, you know, where basically atoms are placed on links of this so-called Kagame lattice, and adjust the Rydberg blockade appropriately, you can basically map the system into something which is called a dimer model. So what, you know, what, how does this mapping work? So suppose you adjust the blockade such that each atom, for each atom, you have six nearest neighbors located. So in this case, the maximal filling of the lattice you can create is filling 1/4. And basically you can think now about, you know, this type of systems in terms of these dimer bonds, where basically each atom corresponds to the dimer bonds. And the Rydberg blockade ensures that none of the two bonds basically touch each other. So that's the idea. So then what we do in our experiments, we just start with the kind of this lattice and do the adiabatic evolution. And then, you know, afterwards we can take the picture and we can identify where these, you know, dimers live. And this is one typical picture. And, you know, I look at that, you say, it's very cool, but, you know, what does it really tell us? And that's, of course, kind of the challenge, because, you know, what we would like to do now is we would like to show that the resulting state of matter will be basically a quantum superposition of all of these so-called dimer coverings, of all of these possible, you know, configurations, you know, of these bonds. So this is the spin liquid state that we would like to prepare and study. The challenge is, of course, that such states cannot be revealed by using only local observables. So we really need to study something like these topological strings. And, you know, that, you know, way we can hopefully try to detect this kind of elusive topological order. So let's see how it all works out. So basically we start again, you know, with atoms in the ground state, do adiabatic sweeps, and then we can, for example, look at average occupation number. So we see that for some range of detunings, we kind of approach this 1/4 filling, that's the right range. But again, you know, in this 1/4 filling, you know, you look at these images, you cannot say, you know, what is going on, right? Whether the system has order or not. So basically what we need to do now is go back to something like a toric code and think about what the topological string operators will look like. And for example, this diagonal string operator Z is very easy to understand. So if you look at this kind of dimer model and you, for example, make a string which is perpendicular to the links of this Kagame lattice, what will happen is that basically if, you know, cross one vertex of this model. So that means that, you know, you will basically cross just one dimer, right? At the maximal kind of dimal covering. So basically this string, the parity of this string, the product of this kind of Z operator will be exactly -1. If we make a bigger loop, you know, then this parity of the string operator should be -1 to the number of enclosed vertices, right? So that's kind of the signature of the so-called dimer phase. And indeed, you know, when we, you know, do this sweep, we observe that, you know, like when we kind of approach this 1/4 filling, you know, this dimer ordering, you know, starts to appear, and we see this dimer ordering on quite big loops. So as the loop size increases, this, you know, the correlations do decrease, but we see this dimer ordering on the substantial fraction of our 219 atom array. But now what we need to do is we need to show that we have a coherent superposition of all of these dimer states. So this is much more tricky because at this point we need to look at off the diagonal string operators. So for example, you can define this X operator as acting on the link of the Kagame lattice as the one which basically switches this different configuration of dimers. And actually, in fact, it turns out that if you define it this way, so if you, for example, look at the closed loop, then this closed loop will precisely probe this, you know, coherence between all of these dimer coverings. So that's the action of this operator on this loop. Now, how can you measure this X? This actually is extremely non-trivial. And actually, this is, you know, the idea which has been developed by Rubin, one of the Ashwin's postdoc. It turns out that we can actually rotate the Z strings into X strings by applying kind of a special kind of operation on triplets of atoms, basically on three nearby atoms, by just changing the size of the Rydberg blockade appropriately and just kind of rotating the, you know, performing this kind of basis rotation, much like you do the basis rotation for the single qubit. So to do it, you know, what we simply do is we change the power of our laser by something like factor of 200, you know, and basically, if you look at this kind of parity, we initially see that the parity kind of decreases, but then when the rotation angle is just right, when the timing is right, we see the revival, which corresponds precisely to measurement of this X string. And basically, using this approach, we can measure again this X string of diagonal string operators across loops, which are basically a fraction of the entire array. And basically, this really corresponds to the coherence between these dimer coverings. Okay, so now, how can we kind of distinguish this spin liquid from different trivial phases? So the key idea is to compare closed loops and open strings. And what you can see experimentally, the effect is quite dramatic. So if you start with this, so for example, if you look at diagonal loop, you know, if you enter this phase, so for negative detuning, where you have still basically mostly atoms in the ground state, these open and closed loops are basically coincide. But when once you enter this, you know, spin liquid kind of regime, a dimer regime, the open loops completely vanish, while closed loops have finite signals. Same thing for X strings. You know, initially they coincide, but once you enter this regime, you know, where you basically favor coherence between the closed loops, you know, open strings go to zero and we see finite parity. And so basically we can quantify it by using the so-called BFFM other parameters, basically looking at ratio of open strings to kind of closed strings. And basically that way we can distinguish quantum spin liquid from trivial phase, from valence bond phase. And in fact, we can, doing this measurement, we can really identify where this spin liquid, you know, onset of the spin liquid occurs. So basically, this is how we can really diagnose when we are entering this regime. We see a dimer phase, we see coherent superposition, and by looking at this BFFM, we exclude trivial phases. So I think I should kind of wrap up, but I just will show you one more thing, you know, and that's kind of a first step to basically making a baby topological qubit. So in here, what we do is we create an array with the hole. And so those of you who know the, you know, things like toric code, you immediately will remember that this kind of, you know, array with the hole, you know, should have now doubly degenerate ground state. So what are these, you know, ground states? So basically they correspond to two distinct topological sectors. So if you look at various dimer coverings, you'll have some dimer coverings of the type like these two, which can be easily, you know, converted with each other to each other by using some kind of local, you know, moves, by looking local flips. But then you'll have dimer coverings like the one on the left, where in order to convert it, you know, from this one to this one, you will have to basically flip the dimers across a much bigger loop, which goes across this hole. So that's the idea. So basically what happens is that, you know, there are these two topological sectors which are defined. And so basically coherent superposition of dimer coverings within each of the sectors will be two degenerate states. They will be actually quantified by this diagonal links going from the center to the edge. You know, for one of them, it will be minus one, another one plus one. So, and, you know, basically, you know, what we would like to do now is we would like to, you know, create, you know, you know, for example, a state of this topological qubit, you know, one of the interesting states could be a superposition state. So what if we try to create basically a state zero logical plus one logical? So in this case, you know, it will be, if we measure the Z, you know, a hole to boundary, it basically should, the expectation value should vanish, but instead there should be another string, an X string, which will actually go around this hole, which should not vanish. And indeed, for one of these should be plus one and another one is minus one. And this is what we measure. And indeed, we observe this region, you know, where precisely in this kind of quantum spin liquid domain, we observe that, you know, this Z string from the middle to the boundary goes to zero, whereas the X string still has a non-zero value. And moreover, this kind of these Z strings, you know, if you draw different ones, they will be, you know, correlated. And this we actually can also check. So basically, this is kind of a first step towards this topological a qubit, this kind of really paradigmatic qubit that Kitaev has described. Okay, I'm going to skip this a little bit. So understanding these experimental observations is very interesting. And in fact, what we learn from doing, you know, ground state DMRG simulations also the kind of, you know, simulating adiabatic falling on much smaller size system scales, we learn that we actually create a spin liquid in a domain where we believe, as far as we know now, in the ground state, the spin liquid should not be the proper state. In fact, it looks like in a domain where we work, some competing phase, in particular this Wallens-Bohn state, should actually win over. However, it turns out that, you know, if you do this time-dependent preparation, you know, using this adiabatic sweep, so this kind of, when we enter this in a system with spin liquid, quantum spin liquid correlations, it actually turns out to be very robust. You know, so basically we don't see any signatures of this valence band solid. So it's a little bit for experts, but basically we believe that our observations correspond to metastable spin liquid state, which is very much akin to the states created in the atomic BEC. So for atomic BEC, the ground state is really a solid. Okay, I think I should stop now, but you know, let me just kind of take a step back. So some of you have probably seen this. It was, I think, a cover of Scientific American in 2006, you know, this kind of idea that someone is breaking with these knots and so on. I think the artist who drew this, you know, this picture must have thought that the physicists, they really got nuts, you know, such a thing, you know, we'll never be able to kind of create. But actually, we can now implement these things where these little strings are nothing but just the laser beams, which makes these kind of little holes and move them around. And, you know, that's actually, it's quite exciting, I must say. So we can really now, you know, touch these topological phases, you know, explore their properties, start to kind of explore these ideas of topological protections. You know, it's related to things like simulating gauge theories and so on. So I think it's a lot of fun. So I think I'm going to skip that part because I'm running out of time. So I apologize, but instead I'll just put the summary slide. So I very much hope that I convinced you that we are kind of entering this domain of quantum discovery. I think there is a lot of, you know, cool things where there's actually theory and experiment are now very, very close and are pushing each other. And finally, I want to, you know, thank all of these people whose blood and sweat resulted in this work. And also thank you for your attention.
All right. Well, thank you for that marvelous talk. So let's see, we have time for a couple of questions. Can I start by asking if there are any student questions? Any students in the audience want to venture a question? If not, any other questions?
Hi, Misha. I had a question about the 2D Ising phase transition.
Yeah.
So the Kibble Zurich results are very amazing.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if it's possible in your setup to also directly prepare the critical point via, you know, just adiabatic evolution, or is that or is the adiabatic limit too stringent in this case?
Well, I mean, no, we can definitely. Maybe I don't understand the question correctly, but so what we do, we go across a critical point, right?
Right.
Of course, we can stop at critical point, right? You know.
And yeah. So if you stop at the critical point, yeah. Have you tried just comparing like 2-point correlations, you know, with those expected from theory? Or?
Yeah. So we talked about these things. So the problem is at the critical point, like, measuring correlations is kind of tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is you sort of don't know in which basis you need to measure, right? So you basically, in a critical point, you kind of, you have this kind of entangled, you know, state, you know, where all of these kind of things correlate. So what we have been talking about is maybe trying to measure entanglement at the critical point. Mm-hmm. So I think that is, it's possible. And, you know, that's something we are looking at. So just measuring correlations, it's, you know, we actually even tried, we did not try to do it in 2D. In 1D, we kind of tried to do it. Somehow that was not very kind of fruitful. I mean, I don't know if you see what I mean, because basically the nice thing is we, if we met, so for us, it's kind of easy to measure like in a Z basis,
mm-hmm.
right? To measure in an X basis, you know, indeed, and that specific experiment is kind of challenging. And we also, you don't even know what the right basis rotation. So you see what I'm saying? So, you know, like measuring just in Z basis correlations at the critical point
mm-hmm.
doesn't give you very much information. I hope that makes sense. But, you know, I think what one could ask a question, can you measure entanglement? And I think that is very interesting, you know. We have some ideas, you know, and we will, we are going to try to do it actually.
Okay. Thanks.
I see Tarun has a question.
Thank you. Just amazing talk. I have no words, but it's super nice. But I had a question about the Ising model again. Mm-hmm. So there's a simple prediction which is very non-trivial, which can only be done actually in your kind of experiment and cannot be done in regular solid state, which is that if you look at just domain wall configuration, suppose because you have pictures of spins, there exists a specific correlation function which involves products of spins all over. It's like a non-local mm-hmm. correlation function, which maps to, in just one sentence, Ising model in 2+1D is dual to a topological order.
Mm-hmm.
This is an Ising duality between a topologically ordered face of a Z2 gauge theory, which is like your Tori code,
yeah.
and an Ising model. Because of a duality, your two faces, we're not even talking about critical point, but the two mm-hmm. faces, the ordered face, disordered face, map to the topologically ordered face and a non-topologically ordered face.
Yeah.
And the domain wall correlation functions map to your Wilson loop.
Uh-huh.
So have you measured those?
Well, you know, we've never looked at it from this perspective, Tarun. I would love to discuss that, you know. So mm-hmm. A, you know, we probably have data.
Right.
The only thing is, again, we only, in that experiment, we only look at one basis, you know, in the mm-hmm. Z basis. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's enough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as you hopefully can also appreciate, over the last couple of months, we became experts in all of these string operators. So
I see that, yeah.
It might be worth, I mean, I'd love to discuss it, you know.
We never
looked at that, and it might be an interesting direction, but we can maybe talk, you know, after
I have to run soon to give a talk, but maybe I will.
That's
email
right. So
you.
We can talk later. You know, we'll be also happy when maybe. Oh, okay, let's discuss it. You know?
Yeah.
It sounds very interesting, you know. And we do realize that this transition in historic code, it should also be Ising transition. So this is something that we would also like very much to study.
Exactly. Even so, that was the second question, because you mentioned entanglement at the critical point. So it's a very specific prediction for the critical point for your Tori code. It'll be basically the entanglement you will measure in your Ising model, and the entanglement you will measure in your toric code at a critical point, the difference of them will be log two. Both of them will be, I mean, the subleading contribution, which is probably hard to get, but there's a universal prediction.
Let's discuss. I mean, this entanglement is generally harder to measure.
Yeah, I think so.
But, you know, we could, I mean, we have, again, some idea. I mean, this definitely would like to take up on, you know, so, But, you know, but absolutely, it's also, for example, we are also kind of, in this kind of toric code, we also see that depending how fast or slow we go, we create different density of anions.
Right.
And we definitely would like to explore Kibble, Zurich, and so on. I mean, like, where that is a direction we very much want to go. I think entanglement is kind of complementary, but these are the things, you know, it's kind of, you know, limited by, you know, creativity and new ideas, you know. Imagination.
Thank you, Tarun. Let's have one final question from Roger.
Thanks, Layton. Hey, Misha, great to see you. Thanks for the amazing talk. Super interesting to see your 219 atom data, on the Z2 spin liquid. Yeah. Just a real selfish question. If I was to ask you for, you know, clean projective measurement data in the occupation basis, like, you know, in your Z basis, how many measurements per detuning parameter could you get, you know, for those typical experiments?
So how many do you need, you know?
10,000.
Basically, it's the repetition rate is about, we have like 10 shots a second.
10 shots a second.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I need. And how long do you keep, like, how long do you keep coherence? Let me put it that way. Or is that a separate preparations for every shot?
You know, every time you prepare a new one, so that's, you know, you can basically have flat, you know, 10 shots. Per second. But you know what, went a little bit kind of fast through that but if you kind of followed, you know, now our understanding is actually we do not create a ground state. Instead, we create this kind of metastable long-lived state, which basically, you know, where we see that some of this, you know, in a ground state, the stuff which wins over, you know, basically, it's just we are not sensitive to that. You know, we just don't couple because it's usually this kind of VBS would be a first order transition. I think we just go across, we just don't, you know. So it's kind of, I think, you know, I know exactly what you are kind of where you are thinking and so on. I think we might need to adjust framework a little bit for that. But absolutely, these are the kinds of things we would love to explore. Yes.
Excellent. Thank you, Misha. Great talk.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, on that note, let's thank Misha one more time for a wonderful talk.
Thank you guys for having me. So it's great to see you all.